Today is Saturday, December 6th, and this is the World Socialist Website.
In major attack on public health, CDC recommends delaying hepatitis B vaccine at birth. In what public health experts are calling the most consequential attack on disease prevention policy in modern U.S. history, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, under the control of the Trump administration, has voted to delay the hepatitis B vaccine for newborns. The decision effectively dismantles the decades-long standard of administering the first dose within the first 24 hours of life, a cornerstone of the universal immunization strategy that has protected millions of infants from a lifelong incurable viral infection. The birth dose is needed because maternal infection is often asymptomatic and screening fails to identify all infectious mothers. This critical vaccination has helped reduce pediatric hepatitis B infections by more than 95% since 1991. This vote by the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, ACIP, is part of the Trump administration's campaign, led by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., to dismantle public health in the United States. What is being implemented under the guise of health freedom is, in fact, the demolition of the very institutions and structures that have protected millions from infectious disease. The path to this outcome was paved through a calculated dismantling of the public health advisory structure, a central component of the Trump administration's broader war on science. Earlier this year, Kennedy took the unprecedented step of firing all 17 members of the existing ACIP panel, historically composed of experts in vaccinology, infectious diseases, epidemiology, and immunology, and replacing them with anti-vaccination advocates. The committee's decision to delay the birth dose runs counter to 40 years of safety and efficacy data. Anticipating the administration's intent to undermine the standard of care, the Vaccine Integrity Project at the University of Minnesota Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy, CDRAP, undertook an independent review of the evidence. Led by Dr. Angela K. Ulrich and Dr. Michael T. Osterholm, the CDRAP analyzed more than 400 studies spanning four decades. Their conclusion was unequivocal. There is no new evidence to suggest that delaying the birth dose would be safer or more efficacious. The review reaffirmed that the birth dose reduces perinatal transmission by about 70% on its own and up to 97% when paired with hepatitis B immune globulin. It also found no causal links between the birth dose and serious adverse events, refuting the pseudoscience used to justify the delay. These findings build upon a vast historical record. A 2024 CDC analysis led by Dr. Fang Jun Zhou, a health economist in the Immunization Services Division, estimated that routine immunizations administered to children born between 1994 and 2023 prevented an estimated 508 million illnesses and 1.1 million deaths, saving nearly $2.7 trillion in societal costs. To justify the delay, the committee raised theoretical concerns about the cumulative effect of vaccines and specific ingredients, such as aluminum adjuvants. Newly appointed ACIP members have been tasked with investigating questions such as whether the two different aluminum adjuvants increase the risk of asthma. But these concerns have already been tested. A landmark nationwide cohort study published in the Annals of Internal Medicine in July 2025, led by Dr. Nicholas Worm Andersen of the Staten Serum Institute in Denmark, examined 1.2 million children and found no association between aluminum adsorbed vaccines and autoimmune, allergic, or neurodevelopmental disorders, including autism and asthma. The consequences of this policy shift have already been modeled in detail, and the projections show a significant rise in preventable illness, cancer, death, and long-term healthcare costs. In a preprint study titled Economic Evaluation of Delaying the Infant Hepatitis B Vaccination Schedule, Eric W. Hall of Oregon Health and Science University assessed the lifetime clinical and economic impact of delaying the birth dose for the 2024 U.S. birth cohort. The model incorporates the realities of the U.S. healthcare system, including imperfect adherence, The well-documented fact that when the birth dose is not administered in the hospital, the likelihood of completing the full vaccine series drops sharply. According to Hall's modeling, even a brief delay of the first dose until 2 months of age for infants born to mothers not known to be infected would result in 1,137 additional preventable acute hepatitis B infections in children, 304 additional cases of liver cancer, 482 additional HBV-related deaths, and $222 million in excess healthcare costs annually. The alarm over the decision has been immediate across the medical and public health community. The American Academy of Pediatrics, AAP, called the delay a direct threat to infant safety, warning that it contradicts every major body of scientific evidence accumulated over four decades. The Infectious Diseases Society of America, IDSO, condemned the vote as an abandonment of the standards that protect children from preventable disease. The Association of Immunization Managers, representing state and territorial immunization programs, cautioned that the shift will undermine the integrity of vaccination schedules nationwide. Members of the CDC Alumni Association described the vote as a grave departure from evidence-based practice and warned that abandoning the birth dose will result in unnecessary and irreversible harm. Several former leaders of the Immunization Safety Office noted that the decision makes no scientific sense and violates the precautionary principle that has guided immunization policy for decades. These warnings, coming from the very people who built the nation's immunization infrastructure, underscore the unprecedented nature of the collapse now unfolding. The vote to delay the hepatitis B vaccine is the most advanced expression of the broader restructuring of American public health by the Trump-Kennedy administration. With far-right anti-vaccination activists now installed across the Health and Human Services, HHS, CDC, and ACIP, the administration has created the machinery to revise and ultimately dismantle the entire childhood immunization schedule and the scientific norms that once governed it. This is part of a broader war on the working class and all remaining social programs. The Trump administration is pursuing the same strategy in every sphere: gutting environmental regulations, dismantling public education, militarizing police forces, and criminalizing political opposition. This transformation, however, did not begin with Trump. The Biden administration played an indispensable role in creating the political and institutional framework for the present collapse of public health. It was Biden who prematurely declared in 2022 that the pandemic was over, dismantled all mitigation measures, ended federal funding for testing and treatment, blocked mask requirements, and forced millions back into unsafe workplaces and schools. The bipartisan Forever COVID policy normalized mass infection, sickness, and death, abandoning the basic principle that society has a responsibility to protect public health. This cultivated the political environment in which Trump and Kennedy can move openly to destroy all that remains of evidence-based policy. What is unfolding is a class offensive. The destruction of public health is an attack on the working class, which depends on social infrastructure for protection from disease, exploitation, and poverty. The rollback of the hepatitis B birth dose is part of a sweeping campaign to eliminate the gains won through more than a century of struggle: vaccines, clean air standards, workplace safety regulations, reproductive rights, and public education. The defense of public health is inseparable from the defense of all democratic and social rights. It cannot be entrusted to either faction of the ruling class. The independent political mobilization of the working class is the only force capable of halting this descent into dictatorship. The defense of science, real science, grounded in evidence and dedicated to human welfare, requires the overthrow of the capitalist system that subordinates life to profit. We urge scientists, healthcare workers, educators, students, and all workers who recognize the danger of this moment to join this fight for socialism.
Survivors of September 2nd boat strike, waved for rescue, did not know they had been attacked. by Andre Damon. The survivors of the U.S. military's September 2nd drone strike in the Caribbean attempted to wave to U.S. military aircraft for rescue and appeared not to understand that the U.S. military had attempted to kill them, the New York Times reported on Friday. The Times, citing people who saw the video following its screening at a meeting before congressional committees yesterday, wrote that, quote, two survivors of the U.S. military's first boat strike on September 2nd climbed atop the overturned hull and waved to something overhead, end quote. The people who saw the video told the Times that the, quote, most logical explanation was that the two survivors had seen the American aircraft above them and started signaling for a rescue, end quote. The report in the Times contradicts the claims of defenders of the Trump administration's drone murders. Quote, I saw two survivors trying to flip a boat loaded with drugs bound to the United States back over so they could stay in the fight, end quote, said Republican Governor Tom Cotton in an attempt to defend the killings. Rather, the video indicates that the survivors had no idea they were in any fight. According to the Times, a person who watched the video added that, quote, it is also not clear if the survivors even knew the initial explosion was an attack, end quote. Last week, the Washington Post reported that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth gave a verbal order to, quote unquote, kill everybody on board the boat, leading to a second strike that killed the two survivors. Legal experts have denounced the strikes as murder and war crime. Quote, it is absolutely unlawful to order that there will be no survivors, end quote, a Cardozo Law School professor told Time magazine. Quote, there is no actual armed conflict here, so this is murder, end quote. The American public has the right to view the recording of the strike, which has so far only been shown to members of Congress behind closed doors. It must be publicly released immediately. The Trump administration, however, will no doubt seek to cover up or even destroy the tape and is counting on the Democrats to help them do it. In 2005, the Bush administration destroyed recordings of the torture of detainees at a CIA black site. At the time, congressional Democrats were made aware of the destruction of the tapes, but did not inform the public. On Thursday, Democratic Representatives Jim Himes and Adam Smith said that the video of the September 2nd missile strike that killed 11 people in the Caribbean showed that two, quote-unquote, shipwrecked individuals were, quote, killed by the United States military, end quote. They added, quote, the video we saw today showed two shipwrecked individuals who had no means to move, much less pose an immediate threat, and yet they were killed by the United States military. End quote. In response to the crisis, the administration has only doubled down, killing another four people in a strike in the coastal waters of Latin America on Thursday. To date, 87 people have been killed in over 20 strikes. The details of the murder come the same day that the Trump administration published a new national defense strategy that places central emphasis on U.S. domination of Latin America as a base of power projection in the conflict with China and other states. The document declares, quote, we want to ensure that the Western Hemisphere remains free of hostile foreign incursion or ownership of key assets, and that supports critical supply chains, and we want to ensure our continued access to key strategic locations. In other words, we will assert and enforce a Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, end quote. It demands, quote, a readjustment of our global military presence to address urgent threats in our hemisphere, to control sea lanes, and to control key transit routes in a crisis, end quote. It declares effectively all of North and South America as, quote-unquote, our hemisphere, giving a generality to the seemingly disparate plans floated by Trump over the past year to annex Panama, Greenland, and Canada, as well as the massive militarization targeting Venezuela. Control of these strategic territories and waterways would give the United States, the Trump administration hopes, the weight to confront China on the global sphere. As the World Socialist website wrote in February following Trump's statement that he intended to annex Canada, there is a direct precedent for Trump's efforts to unify, quote-unquote, our hemisphere in the Anschluss policy of the Nazi regime. Quote, this process is akin to Hitler's push for Anschluss, the joining of Austria to his Third Reich, and subsequent dismemberment of Czechoslovakia, pivotal preparatory steps to Nazi Germany's launching of a broader European war. Trump aims to reorder U.S. imperialism's near abroad and thereby gain unfettered control of its strategic territories and abundant resources. End quote. This plan for world domination entails criminality on a vast scale and has been demonstrated by the killing spree in the Pacific and the Caribbean. Jacobin's defense of the Trump-Mamdani Pact and the capitalist state. Lawrence Porter and Barry Gray. In the aftermath of New York Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani's White House meeting with Donald Trump, in which the so-called, quote-unquote, democratic socialist and the fascist would-be dictator exchanged pleasantries and mutual praise, Jacobin, the unofficial organ of the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, has published a series of articles hailing the meeting and praising Mamdani's capitulation to Trump as a political tour de force. One of the most significant of these articles is a commentary by Christopher Marquis, headlined, Trump and Mamdani agree on the state, not on whom it serves. In the course of the article, Marquis, a professor of management at the University of Cambridge, argues that the capitalist state is not intrinsically hostile to the interests of the working class and can, through prodding from the quote-unquote left, be either pressured to serve the needs of working people or captured outright by them. This argument exemplifies the role of the DSA and the middle-class pseudo-left more broadly in promoting illusions in the Democratic Party and propping up the capitalist system, which is careening toward fascism and world war, defending it against the coming revolutionary challenge from the working class. The article is not an academic exercise. It is a political manifesto by the DSA and Jacobin's privileged petty bourgeois milieu, justifying their open collaboration with the fascistic administration and defending the capitalist state itself. The headlines claim that, quote, Trump and Mamdani agree on the state, end quote, is correct. There is an underlying agreement between the two, as well as the DSA, that the existing state is sacrosanct. Marquis and Jacobin go out of their way to reassure the corporate oligarchy that it has nothing to fear from their so-called democratic socialism. Quote, on the basic questions of how the economy is organized, Marquis writes, quote, Trump is not at all that different from Mamdani, end quote. At one point, he sums up the pathetic goal of Mamdani and company as giving the state, quote, a firm nudge toward public value, end quote. Lest there be any remaining concerns, he writes, quote, when Mamdani advances democratic socialist policies, he's not suggesting we abolish markets, end quote. Marquis defines the, quote, underlying issue, end quote, as, quote, economic governance, end quote, with emphasis on the word governance in the original. This is a false statement that could be taken from the talking points of any run-of-the-mill Democratic politician. In reality, the underlying issue is the social relations of production under capitalism, in which the capitalists own the means of production, and the workers, who produce all of the wealth, own nothing but their ability to work, which they must sell to their exploiters in return for a wage. These relations generate an irreconcilable class struggle, leading either to the revolutionary overthrow of capitalism by the working class and the establishment of a workers' state and socialism, based on common ownership of the means of production, equality in production for social need rather than private profit, or a descent into fascist barbarism and nuclear war. There is not a hint of class struggle or working class revolution in the Jacobin article, or in the politics of the DSA and Mamdani. On the contrary, this is their greatest fear, which leads them into the arms of the fascist representative of the oligarchy, Trump. Government of, by, and for the oligarchy. It is striking that Marquis's representation of the political situation, couched in abstract academic jargon, provides no sense of the staggering and unprecedented levels of wealth concentration and social inequality in today's America. It says nothing about Trump's fascist pogrom against immigrants, his unconstitutional deployment of troops to major cities, and his assertion of dictatorial powers, his support for genocide in Gaza, or his illegal military attacks on Iran, Venezuela, and other countries. This, however, is not surprising in a commentary that argues the state machine is not by its nature an instrument of the ruling class, and that it can be won, at least in part, to the side of workers. It would hardly be convenient to acknowledge the facts that show the Trump administration is a government of, by, and for an unaccountable financial oligarchy that consists of a tiny fraction of the population. In his recent lecture, Where is America Going? Oligarchy, Dictatorship, and the Revolutionary Crisis of Capitalism, the chairman of the World Socialist Website International Editorial Board, David North, painted a devastating portrait of contemporary U.S. society. He reviewed the, quote, historically unprecedented breakdown of American democracy, end quote, under conditions of the rise of a super-rich oligarchy wielding direct political power. He noted that 16 of Trump's top 25 appointees are among the country's 813 billionaires, in a country where the richest 1% hold tens of trillions of dollars in wealth, while 75% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck, and nearly half of all children are poor or low income. As the WSWS has repeatedly pointed out, such levels of inequality are incompatible with democratic forms of rule. In his foundational work of 1916, Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism, Vladimir Lenin wrote of the monstrous depredations against the working class of, quote, state monopoly capitalism, end quote, with its massive concentration of wealth and economic power in the hands of a relatively small number of corporate behemoths. Imperialism, Lenin wrote, meant, quote, reaction all along the line, end quote. But the growth of oligarchic rule today has put the concentration of wealth at the very top far beyond what existed in Lenin's day. The class function of the state has never been more naked, rendering absurd the DSA's politics of tinkering around the edges of the capitalist status quo. Marquis's argument is not merely wrong in theory, it serves a definite class function. Jacobin is an organ of the DSA and a broader affluent middle-class layer clustered in academia, NGOs, and the trade union bureaucracy. This milieu has grown socially and politically dependent on the capitalist state, on public grants, tenured posts, foundations, and the managed left spaces supplied by the Democratic Party. Its material interests bind it to the preservation of the existing order, even as it cultivates a left-wing image through rhetoric about democratic socialism and identity politics. Marxism on the State. Against Jacobin and the DSA, it is necessary to restate the ABCs of Marxism on the State. Engels, in The Origin of Family, Private Property, and the State, explained that the state is, quote, a product and a manifestation of the irreconcilability of class antagonisms. The state arises where, when, and insofar as class antagonisms objectively cannot be reconciled. And conversely, the existence of the state proves that the class antagonisms are irreconcilable. End quote. The state is not an umpire standing above society, but the organized power of one class to suppress another. It's, quote, special bodies of armed men, prisons, etc., end quote, exist to maintain the domination of the exploiting class. In September of 1917, in the run-up to the October Revolution, Lenin wrote The State and Revolution precisely to combat the type of reformism now propagated by Jacobin. Lenin wrote while in hiding from the repression unleashed against the Bolsheviks by the bourgeois provisional government following mass working-class demonstrations in July. He wrote the pamphlet following the failed military coup by General Kornilov at the end of August to prepare the party to lead the workers and soldiers in the armed overthrow of the bourgeois government and establishment of a workers' state. Lenin waged theoretical and political war against all those who sought to adapt Marxism to bourgeois parliamentarism and social reformism. This included Karl Kautsky, a leading theoretician of the German Social Democratic Party and Second International, who opposed the revolutionary overthrow and destruction of the capitalist state and preached a peaceful, parliamentary road to socialism. Lenin was at the same time combating right-wing tendencies within the Bolshevik leadership. In the beginning of his preface to The State and Revolution, Lenin wrote, quote, the struggle to free working people from the influence of the bourgeoisie in general, and of the imperialist bourgeoisie in particular, is impossible without a struggle against opportunist prejudices concerning the state. End quote. He explained that the central lesson of the 1871 Paris Commune was that the working class could not simply take over the bourgeois state machine and use it for its own purposes. It had to dismantle it and replace it with organs of workers' power. Lenin, under conditions of war and revolutionary upheaval, undertook a systematic, quote-unquote, historical excavation of Marx and Engels on the state to arm the Bolshevik Party and the international working class for the seizure of power. Trotsky noted that Lenin considered this so critical that, fearing assassination, he asked comrades to publish his preparatory notebooks on Marxism and the state should he be killed. See, From the July Days to the Kornilov Coup, Lenin's The State and Revolution. Lenin stressed that under imperialism, the repressive apparatus of the capitalist state assumed, quote-unquote, monstrous proportions, while democracy became a fig leaf for militarism and police violence. The task of the proletariat was not to, quote, redraw boundaries, end quote, a la Jacobin, within this apparatus, but to smash it and build a workers' state based on new, radically democratic institutions, Soviets, as the instruments of socialist transformation. This is all the more true today. The anti-Marxist purveyors of illusions in social reform, from Syriza in Greece to Podemos in Spain to the Left Party in Germany to Sanders in the U.S., have all betrayed the working class. The working class must establish its political and organizational independence from all parties and agencies of the capitalist state, from the Democrats and the pseudo-lefts and the trade union bureaucracies. Rank-and-file committees must be built in workplaces, schools, and working-class communities in the U.S. and internationally, affiliated with the International Workers' Alliance of Rank-and-File Committees, IWARFC. The Revolutionary Party, the International Committee of the Fourth International, and its American section, the Socialist Equality Party, must be built to lead the struggle to expropriate the oligarchy and overthrow capitalist rule. The objective conditions for socialist revolution are maturing rapidly. The same technological and economic processes, such as AI, which have driven the rise of oligarchy, are also creating the material basis for the mass political radicalization of the working class. The decisive issue is the building of a revolutionary leadership capable of turning this objective movement into a conscious struggle for power. For these articles and more, visit the World Socialist website at wsws.org. For the World Socialist website, this has been Jesse Thomas.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.